be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond, beyond.
Please join us in the chat room at www.wolfspiritradio.com/listen. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Indeed, let me now just get rid of this picture here. Stop that. And there we are. Yes. Hello, everybody. This is JP. And welcome to my messy little studio here in the north of Scotland. And just there we go. Oh, I'll nip out in a minute and get my NASA hat. I actually got a hat. It's not really mine. It's for my son from Sean David Morton, who sent it to me in the parcel with the tax per queue and all this clever stuff. So for $3, he sent this. And a NASA cap over for my son as well. So, for 3 cents, figure that one out. Anyhow, so my guest tonight is Brett Colin Shepherd. You see him flashing up on the screen now. Brett Colin Shepherd, you've spent a lot of time doing a lot of research into many, many things. And, one of the things I mentioned was that, Ken Johnston? I can't remember which one.
Yeah, Ken Johnston Sr.
Ken Johnston Sr. And he has the massive NASA collection of photographs, which you have been diligently researching through. So the reason we're doing a TV rather than the radio tonight is because, well, you want to show us some pictures, don't you? That'd be really cool.
I do.
So, Brett, here's the soapbox, as Dave used to say, and away you go.
Okay. My name is Brett Colin Shepherd. I'm the founder of the Lunar Anomaly Research Society, and I am an experiencer. I've experienced many strange things in my life that have to do with the space agency. Of course, early on, I didn't know that at the time. The CIA was doing, of course, experiments, psychological experiments and experiments into remote viewing and that sort of thing. I had not heard of Ingo Swann or anybody that did remote viewing until much later when they disclosed those declassified those documents. Some of the more astounding evidence of the secret space program, like in the late 40s and early 50s, it was a pinnacle time related to the human discovery of new technologies and interactions with extraterrestrials. In 1947, we had the Roswell crash, of course, which there was a heavy military concern and involvement. Sergeant Homer Rollitt Jr. confessed to his daughter in 1988 after acquiring Agent Orange in Vietnam and knew he was not going to live long. And while on the gurney to go into the military hospital, he grabbed his daughter and said, "Baby, the story's true, and don't let anyone tell you any different. There was a spacecraft and there were grays out there." His daughter kissed him and said that that was the last time I got to talk to my dad. She stated that her father was very committed to his family and country. There was Henry W. McElroy Jr., former legislator for the state of New Hampshire during the Eisenhower administration, remembers an undisclosed briefing that stated a meeting could be arranged as appropriate with President Eisenhower if desired, and disclosed ongoing presence of extraterrestrial beings in the United States of America. The tone of this brief showed that the visitors were in no way causing harm and basically had no intention of causing disruption then or in the future to the continuity of the country or the world. Though it was not verified that the meeting took place because of Ike's optimism in 1961, Mr. McElroy felt that a meeting did take place between the president and extraterrestrial off-world astronauts. Paul Hillier, former Minister of Defense of Canada, interviewed a former chief of emergency measures who stated that when he went to Langley Air Base in America and the CIA asked him if he would like to see one of these UFOs, he flew him out to Area 51. He had to sign an oath of secrecy and then did, in fact, see crashed extraterrestrial craft in the hangar. The CIA allowed him on board this craft and observe it as well as take notes so that he may better deal with the issue if it ever arises again. He was told never to tell anyone and didn't include his, and he didn't, including his wife. Paul Hellier explained that there are ETs that look so much like us that we wouldn't be able to tell the difference. And there are grays that are also called extraterrestrial biological entities that deal, that a deal was made with them for a limited amount of human abductions in exchange for technologies. And that these technologies were used in the advancement of weapons and aircraft for which we are, that are so identical to the ET craft that no one could tell if they were extraterrestrial or ours. This amazing story of cooperation by a former CIA official and that even on his deathbed did not give his real name for his family's sake. The former CIA official states that he worked under the Eisenhower administration on Project Blue Book, for which he previously names the project, and previously it was the name of the project and was said to be a fraud or a cover for the true story of extraterrestrials. He stated that Eisenhower was going into Area 51 with troops to take over the base and that things were peacefully resolved after Eisenhower gave the ultimatum of the guys from Area 51 to report to Washington, D.C. in a week, or he would take the First Army and invade Area 51. He met with extraterrestrials at the time when it was arranged for him to do so. The CIA official stated that the Roswell craft was in fact real, and he saw it looked strange, like a heavy aluminum foil weighing about 150 to 300 pounds, as you could rock it, he said. He said in layman's terms, it was powered by rivers of a type of gravitational thing, river type gravitational thing of some kind. Some kind of reversed gravitics. He stated that at the time he received the mathematical code for reverse gravity on a 3x5 card, he said there were different types of grays, and at S4 he viewed the autopsy film of the decaying, the deceased alien. He was one of the two flight crewmen that were having the conversation that was overheard by Mr. Kirkland, who was also there at the time. And it's strange how all of these corroborating details of this story, through spans of time and different people from different areas, different walks of life have come together and, have matched the story up. In the main hangar at Area 51 at the time, the SR-71, a precursor to the Blackbird, as well as the U-2 spy plane, which wasn't supposed to exist at the time, was present. Eisenhower, Nixon, and Hoover were privy to this information. And I believe this air base he's talking about was Holloman Air Base in New Mexico. So the CIA official said that they were all worried that the black budget programs existed without the president knowing. Sometime after Eisenhower gave the warning speech to the country about the dangers of the military-industrial complex, Eisenhower and the rest of the men decided to keep all of these things secret from the public for fear of public backlash in the areas of religion and economics. Continuity became a main concern for the military insecurity at the time, which was very high as there was the Red Scare and the Cold War developing. The military definitely had something to hide from the public. Paul H. Utz, an Area 51 employee at Nellis Air Base, was an optical engineer who went to work in an unmarked 737 with the red stripe down where the windows are. The flight that took him from Las Vegas to Area 51 was also known as Dreamland. He worked with Tom Hamilton on the missile range. After he retired, he told his son everything. His son stated that his father told him that he was given different technologies that were said to come from various universities and that he was to do certain things with that technology. He tested different types of energy sources that were said to have blown up on the range. And on the evening, he described seeing a stealth bomber come out in the news, and his father made a phone call and picked up the phone, and the men discussed who leaked the information to President Carter, who released sensitive information about this technology to the news to further his public agenda. His father was one of the suspects for the leak, but was found innocent of the allegations. He also stated that his father eventually was promoted to a Q clearance. Though his father never had complete access to Area 51, the story is suggestive of secret technology during the Carter administration. Colonel Lauren Ross Dedrickson received an MBA degree at Stanford Business School and was assigned to the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission. Long service with the Energy Commission between 1950s and 1958 included contract administration duties at Nevada test sites, Pacific Nuclear Test Area west of Hawaii, nuclear weapon manufacturing quality assurance in Albuquerque, and inspection in nuclear and non-nuclear facilities throughout the country. He stated that the Apollo 13 mission had help from extraterrestrial craft coming back from the moon, and that there was a time when they thought that they would have to bring the astronauts aboard the ET craft. It seemed to be apparent that there was a secret space program alongside the public program that used rudimentary means to accomplish its goals. When I say that, I mean rockets. I mean fuel, you know. When I first met Dr. Ken Johnston, yes, I already had heard the stories of the existing lunar archive and the lunar base from his numerous interviews. I never in a million years thought I would actually see that with my own eyes. And I believe you have too, JP.
Well, we did do a show a while ago with the three of us. That was pretty spectacular. So you've got presumably some new data that you've been working on since then. And new discoveries. And you're quite a dot connector, Brett. You're joining this higher technology, super technology with ancient history going all the way back to all the pre-Roman civilizations in Middle Europe and all of that stuff. We've spoken about that before. But that's the kind of context that people should be listening to this material in. It's part of a very much larger human process.
There is. It's absolutely everything that we're experiencing now, and they have from the 50s on, even earlier, 1942, you know. We have experienced extraterrestrial communications and contact that have helped us with technology in other areas. And even our ancients, the ones that first came here from space, they had a direct communication with the moon through an interdimensional projection from the sun, if that makes sense.
So tell us more about
the
that.
Sun would actually, yes, the sun would actually, they'd look at the, if you can imagine to the scenario where you have this ancient, they're sitting on a rock by a tree or something, and they're looking at the moonlight, and they're looking at the moon, and they're downloading this very sensitive information because there's not the cluster of electromagnetics and all of this cell towers and all of this interference. They have direct contact visually and psychosomatic, you know, information. It's like a dream, like a graphic thing that comes in and it basically touches your emotions and your senses. And you get pictures that become an inner dialogue and a translation. So we've got this moonlight that is direct from the sun, and these other dimensionals are shining onto the moon. And I've seen this actually on our lunar images from NASA. So I've got a huge collection of those as an artist, you know, and I'm looking at these, and they really do tell the story of our ancient affiliation with space. So,
so yeah. Exactly. Now, okay, so fast forward back to these days, and I was, yes. You know, one of the things that always fascinated me, you know, the last couple of years has been the whole Glocker, Red Mercury, Aldebaran, Vril Society, you know, that whole thing. Not necessarily interested in the Nazis themselves or the evil that they wreak, but, this.
Yeah, me neither.
Exactly. But the, but they were looking for they were doing what we were, they're a bunch of hippies basically, and they were looking for free energy.
Right. Well, Tesla, you know, Tesla was also in communication with extraterrestrials. And got a lot of his genius downloads from those extraterrestrials and from space. So, you know, he absolutely admitted that. Another one was Wernher von Braun that said that their technology came from extraterrestrials, as well as, some of the other Nazi scientists that were brought over by Project Paperclip. So, now the Vril Society and the Thule Society were kind of pre-Nazi. That was sort of when the movement was coming around.
Yes, and when it was all idealistic.
These guys, you know, they were connected to Helena Blavatsky and other people, the Vril girls, you know, Maria Orsic and all of them. There was also a guy, that was a Freemason, and he was actually with a Rosicrucian, I believe. And he was also with the Teutonic Order, from Turkey. So this guy, you know, brought in a lot of the ancient, the real true ancient ideas of that Vril Society. And the girls were, of course, very connected with this because they grew up along the Danube River, which was, basically named after, Danae, the goddess, you know, or princess, you know, that was kept in the tower and was the mother of Perseus and all of that, you know, as far as the story goes. These are from the ancient Pelasgian Empire. And this Pelasgian Empire is what the Greeks call pre-Greek.
Okay, know, so can you, first of all, okay, sorry, Brett. I do need to interrupt you every so often because the breadth of what you're saying really requires, we need some bite-sized chunks, you know, otherwise it's, so, Pelagian. First of all, I've never heard of the Pelagians, until I heard you. Can you fix the Pelagians in, like, you know, for instance, in my timeline at least, first there's the Sumerians, then the Babylonians, and then the Romans, and then the Greeks. No, then the Greeks, and then the Romans. Is that the right order? And
okay.
Is there some, you know, this is like what our classical history is supposed to be, isn't it?
I'm going to tell you something really shocking.
Shock
this was 6,000 years. It was 6,000 years prior to Sumeria.
So Pelagian is 6,000 years prior to Sumeria, and where were they situated?
They were the ones that started in Scythia and migrated through the Ukraine, you know, from the Caucasus Mountains to Romania, and they were called the Dacians. They were horseback riders, and they developed a somewhat of an empire all on their own, and they had the Dacian tribes all over there. And they migrated also down to Thracia, which was what Troy actually was. And so this was, Troy did happen before Sumeria. You know, the whole thing.
All right. Okay. Hang on. They're saying they want to see me as well. Hang on. I'm just how do I do this? I've got to stop. There we go.
Oh, good.
All right, there we go.
I agree. I want to see you as well. There you go.
There you are. Because I am kind of down there, I think, in your picture. Is that right?
You bet.
Yeah, so, right, so, did you say 6,000 years before Sumeria?
Yes, absolutely.
6,000 years before Sumeria. So that plants it directly before the end of Atlantis, which we presume to be 10,000 years ago. If that's
correct. You know, this is right after the Ice Age. Yeah.
So right after the Ice Age, which was possibly caused by, it was a meteor impact in Atlantis, in Antarctica, what is now Antarctica?
Well, there's a lot of theories. I think it has something to do with the solar, the solar cycles.
All right.
You know,
but there's also,
the sun was cold.
They've just found, or they found recently, a big gravitational anomaly in Antarctica in a kind of depression. It looks like a big cannonball hitting, you know, making a big hole in Atlantis.
Yeah, down there by New Schwabland.
Yes. Yeah. And,
Nazis,
so, yeah, talk about, tell us about Neuschwabenland, yeah?
Well, it is said, you know, it is rumored that the high Nazi officials, really escaped. They faked their deaths or whatever. Some of them went to Argentina and some of them went to, actually took UFOs, Nazi type, Vril craft to New Schwabland and, developed a base there. Apparently, you know, at the end of the war, while the war was going on. And, they weren't alone in that. They also, they were actually, in cooperation with the United States. So this wasn't just a Nazi base. It was also our Nazis in the United States.
Yeah, because, nowadays, well, after there was a certain group of Nazis who are now starting to infiltrate the back of the government. Who have since become, you know, the Bush, Clinton cabal, really, haven't they?
Yeah, they've absolutely taken over in all areas, psychology, media, everything. They've completely taken over. You know, I wish Americans knew how much psychological testing has been done on them throughout the years. But, the thing is that during that time period, in the early 50s, it was actually, you know, 48, you know, this time period was very important because, the Nazis very much believed in their Project Valkyrie, which was to take the elite, the best of the best in scientists and healthcare and everything else, to another place where they could set up and start their race over again. So that's what New Schwabland was all about to begin with, was to look for a place, to map out a place where they could all go if the world was against them, so to speak.
However, they couldn't. They didn't go alone, did they? They didn't get there alone.
No, they certainly did not get there alone. I believe that not just. They weren't the only ones that had help. We also had help with our space program, and we took that technology from the Nazis, whatever we could get. And like I said, I believe that they were in cooperation the whole entire time. And these Nazi scientists and everything, we're working with extraterrestrials that rudimentarily got us into space with the public perceived idea of using rockets and other things that looked practical in public, when all the while they had anti-gravity. And so that was the thing, is it was incredibly dangerous for us to go to space, and we did go to the moon in rockets, you know. And
exactly.
But we didn't get to the moon. We didn't get to the moon in rockets without extraterrestrial help.
And we didn't
they were
come
with
back
us the entire time.
And according
they
to
didn't come back, yeah.
According to another Brett, Brett Stillings. Do you know Brett Stillings?
I know William, yeah.
Yeah. So he was on the show the other day. And one of the things he was saying is that we really did go to the moon with all the big tech and all this stuff, but we didn't take off from the moon using a rocket. It was a gravitational device that lifted it off.
That's
and
correct.
You can see it wobble as it takes off. And the other thing, Brett, all right, so here's the other thing. Who took that film of the thing? Who tracked did I ask you that question last time, but who tracked the lunar takeoff? I know we're going around millions
right.
of
people. Well, I can tell you the simple answer to that. There was a camera set up on the moon to do panoramic shots. And it was a remote control camera, and that was the camera that they used officially.
Well, it was really well done because they tracked it in real time. So,
but yeah, maybe, you know, amazing, you know,
it's very good. I mean, these guys are good. They do a lot of rehearsal, don't they? It's like rehearsed over and over again.
If you ask me, the most of the moon landing shots were fake. I'll just say it. I believe those are not the real deal because I know what's on the moon. And that's not what's on the moon. Just nothing and no stars or nothing, you know. So there is definitely something going on with that. The orbiter images are pretty accurate. That's kind of accurate, but they've still brushed everything out, made sure when they went over areas that were kind of plain, you know. The thing is that they were 65 miles up in the air and you can't really see good details, but all of the film and everything we got was always low resolution. So you couldn't really tell what was actually on the surface.
So that's for the lunar orbiter. But, looking at the footage, okay, the lunar orbiter went round the whole moon orbiting, right? And presumably part of the way.
Yes. It would actually orbit part of the way as far as the lunar orbiter, but the command module actually circled around the moon.
Right.
You know.
Okay. So one of these things took photos of the moon all the way around, didn't it?
Absolutely. The command module and the data acquisition camera.
Uh-huh. Okay. The thing you were talking about the other day? Is that one of the...
Yes,
the
The
DAC.
Yeah, there was... Absolutely. There was on Apollo 14, for example, there was one data acquisition camera on the command module and there were two on the LEM. There was a handheld one and there was one that was set up in the window of the LEM, the lunar module. And actually Edgar Mitchell was the one that was taking the film when they were spinning around. When Ken Johnston said that he had taken he was asked to go get some film from the stock room to show Dr. Page and his scientific friends the moon. It was of the Apollo 14 mission, and the film that he showed was a zoom in of Tsiolkovsky crater, and Edgar Mitchell was the one that actually took that film. And I have if I can share this, I have slides.
This is what it's all about. Come on, show us the stuff. Whip out your library, Brett. We've been dying for this.
Okay. Let's see, desktop. Let's see if I can start this here. Share. The desktop here. Ah, there we go. Okay. So here we go. Do you see that?
Yep, a secret base on the moon, and I'm going to present to you so that I don't interrupt your slideshow. Go ahead.
Okay, here is a secret base on the moon. This man, Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, who the crater was actually named after, he was the father of rocketry and was the inspiration for the young Wernher von Braun, the propaganda for the U.S. space program, has its philosophical roots here and were made clear by the Russian film 1936 called Cosmic Voyage, based on, the Russian books that I can't pronounce, was initially conceived in 1924 by Russian filmmaker Vasily Zirafilov, but it was not pursued for production until 1932, for who Tsiolkovsky was the writer and advisor for that film. It is like deep, it's like exact propaganda of the NASA missions, okay? Tsiolkovsky was the first to conceive the idea of a base on the moon in the book he wrote in 1928 called The Will of the Universe, and it's of no consequence that the very crater named Tsiolkovsky just happened to be the same crater Dr. Ken Johnston Sr. saw the lunar base in from the 16-millimeter film he showed to Dr. Thornton Page back at NASA, formerly NACA, in 1971. Let's wait a second for that to come up. There's Project Horizon in 1959. U.S. Army plans to build a lunar base. There is a requirement for a manned military outpost on the moon. The lunar outpost is required to develop and protect potential United States interests on the moon, to develop techniques of a moon-based surveillance of the Earth and space in communications relay, the operations of the surface of the moon, to serve as a base exploration of the moon and further exploration into space, and the military operations on the moon if required, and to support scientific investigation on the moon. This was to establish the establishment of the outpost should be a special project having authority and priority similar to the Manhattan Project in World War II. Once established, the lunar base will be operated under control and unified space command space, or certainly the portion of outer space encompassing the Earth and the moon. We will be considering a military theater. It will be considered a military theater to the control of all the United States military forces by unified commands is already established, and military operations in space should be no exception. The Unified Space Command will be controlled and utilized besides the lunar base, operational military satellites and space vehicles, space surveillance systems, and the logistical support thereof. Other space commands might be organized in our operations extending to the lunar, translunar space. And that was Arthur Gilbert Trudeau. He was Eisenhower's best friend. They went to war together. Okay. So here we have Colonel Lauren Ross Dedrickson. He received an MBA degree. I had read that already, so I'll skip that. Let's see. And he stated that Apollo 13, of course, had help from E.T. Craft coming back from the moon. And there was a time when they thought they would have to bring the astronauts aboard. And I had stated that earlier. That we have a secret space program alongside our traditional civilian propaganda space program, which is a cover for all of that. When I came to New Mexico, we decided to write Ken's Moon. Ken wrote it, actually. We decided to help him edit it and all of that. So when I came here, I met Dr. Ken Johnston Sr. I already heard the stories of the existence of a lunar archive and the lunar base from numerous interviews. I had said that, exclaimed before, that I never thought I would actually get to see the actual images, you know, when I was hitting a wall, because I needed to see a control image. And all I was seeing was NASA official images, which were, you know, the backgrounds were scrubbed out, things were scrubbed off of that image. I began chatting with Ken, and we had a lot in common. Interests included affiliations with the lunar images, of course, and I was hunting anomalies to include embedded lunar and Mars imagery I saw in 1982. There were a lot of images that were shown to me by someone from Stanford Research Institute named Zamina Zarita, and she asked me what I thought of all of these images, and I didn't think anything of them until 40 years later, when I saw them actually in the lunar images. You wouldn't believe what she showed me. Anyway, to work with him, Karen Christine Patrick, working on his autobiography, we studied his story about the lunar base he saw in the 16-millimeter film back in the NASA years that he showed Dr. Thornton Page and some of his close colleagues. I found his story to be true, except for a few details, to which mission the film was made, but remembered the crater, and it helped me figure out by looking at when he worked at, in the data and photo control department and matched up with a specific Apollo mission. Before, he wasn't sure which mission it was, and we found that it was Apollo 14. Since then, I discovered within the mission transcripts that Edgar Mitchell did, in fact, film Tchaikovsky Crater, just as Ken said in his story. I also found 70mm image from Apollo 14 showing the exact sun angle Ken described. Debunkers have always given him a hard time with his specific facts, but his story has never changed about what he saw that day in the 16mm DAC film from Apollo 14. Though the actual film is missing or hidden, we have collected other evidence which affirms Ken's story, and these are the facts of his extraordinary story. Here's Edgar Mitchell. This is at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory after debriefing, and he's looking at the lunar rocks with Alan Shepard and Stuart Russo. Right here, I know that's really tiny for you guys to read, but it actually says that Ken did a good job working at the Data and Photo Control Department. That's Brian Erb right there. And here's I cut this out so you guys could see it better. It says, on behalf of Dorothy Fallon and Dr. Jeffrey Warner, I would like to commend Mr. Ralph Kennedy Johnston for his performance in the lunar sample and data photo area. Mr. Johnston was assigned to this position in response to our action document. There was a lot going on at that time. The guy, Dr. Warner, was in charge of that department, and it had gone pretty chaotic, you know. He had a hard time organizing it, and Ken stepped in, and he did a great job organizing that. Let's see. We've got – oh, I wanted to read that for you guys. Dr. Thornton Page knew exactly what 16mm film Ken needed to retrieve for him to show the other scientists after the astronauts debriefed. Dr. Page had already seen it because he knew which canister number to tell Ken. Here's a picture of Tsiolkovsky Crater in Apollo 14. And those little tiny balls that you see in the crater area is very reflective of what Ken always said, that they looked kind of like when you put your fingers together, they looked like five domes. So let's see, we've got... This is the original film. The original film of the lunar base was shot by Dr. Edgar Mitchell from the LEM on the third day at 2:30 p.m. above the lunar surface with the data acquisition camera. And that is the picture of the actual camera that took that film. And it, let's see, we've got here the Apollo 14 onboard voice transcriptions. The 16mm Moyer data access camera, acquisition camera. Apollo 14 carried three Moyer data acquisition cameras, one in the command module, two in the LEM. The cameras were used to record engineering data, continuous sequence, terrain photography of the lunar surface photography. The CM camera had lenses 5mm, 10mm, 18mm, and 75mm focal lengths. One of the LEM cameras was fitted with a 10mm wide angle lens. Remember that word wide. And that contained a battery pack using a 5mm lens. Accessories include the right-handed angled mirror, a power cable, and sextant adapter. That's the thing that they look through. The sextant is just for navigational purposes. And the CM bore sight window bracket. Moyer cameras weighed about 2.8 pounds each with a 140-foot film magazine attached. They had a frame rates of 1, 6, and 12 frames per second, automatic and 24 frames per second, semi-automatic at all lens focal lengths and shutter speeds. And this, I'd like to also say that this camera kind of worked like a gun sequence camera. There's Apollo 14. Edgar Mitchell was the lunar module pilot who filmed Tchaikovsky with the data acquisition camera. Stuart Russo was the command module pilot. Alan Shepard was the CDR. He was riding alongside Edgar Mitchell in the LEM.
No relation though, Brett.
Okay. No. I am actually cousins with Alan Shepard, if you're asking.
Ah.
It's a distant cousin thing, yes. That's good. So here's the Apollo 14 transcript and the particular area, which I know is a little bit small to read, but I blew it up for you guys.
Can you go full screen on this rather than seeing the...
I will try. Let's see.
Do go to view and see if you got full screen. Not to do
How's
these...
that?
Yeah, can't see anything yet.
Okay. Does it show yet? No?
No. See at the top you go view.
Yep. Let's see. At the top I do view.
Yeah, and see if it says full screen somewhere.
Let's see. No. It doesn't quite do it, but, you know, I knew this would happen, so I blew it up a little bit.
All right, thanks anyway.
All right. So anyway, the Apollo 14 lunar module pilot Edgar Mitchell surrendered this flown to the moon 16-millimeter data acquisition camera to settle a federal lawsuit against him. He was supposed to have left it on the moon, but he kept it for a souvenir. And the film cartridge is missing. The actual camera credit is the from the FLSD. And this is the actual camera that was used. Here is a picture of the camera mounted in the window, and there was another one that was handheld. Edgar Mitchell filmed Tchaikovsky with 60-millimeter data acquisition camera. Apollo astronaut Edgar Mitchell had decided to give up the camera he kept as a memento in 1971 moon mission rather than face a federal lawsuit over his ownership. In the settlement he reached with the U.S. government filed in the district court of Southern Florida on Thursday, the this was October 27th, six-man to walk on the moon agreed to relinquish all claims to ownership, legal title, or dominion over the data acquisition camera that flew with him aboard NASA's Apollo 14 mission. Why do they give a crap about this stupid camera, right? Mitchell agreed to allow Bonhams, the New York auction house where he had consigned the camera for sale just last June, to release the artifact to the government. Bonham had estimated the camera's value to be $60,000 to $80,000. 16-millimeter camera, which was one of the motion picture cameras on board Apollo 14, lunar module Antares, when it landed on the moon on February 5th, 1971, will be given within 60 days to the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. for display. James Zoberg, you know, he's Ken's debunker, basically. He said, quote, I've run off the Apollo 14 orbit of the moon. The only time it was in range of Tchaikovsky was after TEI returned to Earth as it coasted away from the moon. And the window shot of 70-millimeter were getting whole hemisphere wide angle, several of which had Tchaikovsky near the window or the horizon on the Terminator. I've confirmed there were no 16-millimeter Cinegun camera sequences during the brief moment when Tchaikovsky was in view. If Johnson Shepard thinks this confirms the smoking alien moon-based story, they're farther around the bend than I thought. It utterly destroys the story's credibility by showing it was physically impossible for Apollo 14 to take such views straight down. I don't even know what he's talking about. Because right here in the transcript, it shows that the lunar module pilot, he said, this is Edgar Mitchell, I'm going to see that it's all set up for the acquisition, minus 39 plus 325. Those were the camera, you know, specs. Okay, I'm going high gain, manual, wide. Remember that word wide I was telling you guys to remember. And the they're 6 minutes away from it. That was the data acquisition camera, 16-millimeter, right there. On it looks good through the sextant, is what Alan Shepard said. And Stuart Rusin said, what? And Alan Shepard said, sure, it looks good through the sextant. Command module pilot said, well, I think I've got a reddish tint to it out the window, sort of like, you know, the Southwest desert. You know, red hasn't been mentioned before. Do you see Tchaikovsky over there? And Edgar Mitchell, and this was the time Ken's film was shot, 2:30, 23 seconds. And he said, oh, sure, that's Tchaikovsky. Okay, I've got it. Yes, that mother is black out there, isn't it? And flat. And there were really a lot more color differences than I expected. So that was the actual time in the transcripts that Ken's film was actually shot. And there's a little recreation of what Ken saw on the film. And that little, very blurry little image there is the actual image, of what's actually there in Tsiolkovsky Crater, right at the edge where I'm showing the fake lunar base. All right. So here we go. This is the approximate area where Ken saw the lunar base. And this is James Oberg actually showing him film from the command module, not the lunar module, which the film was taken, but the command module, 60mm film. It shows a little circular type film and it goes really quick. And Ken's like, that's not the film I saw. Okay. So he said through, though shown 60mm landmark tracking video from Apollo 14 in Houston, 2014, Ken was adamant it was not what he remembered seeing because the film Ken saw was taken by Edgar Mitchell from the lunar module seen in the image taken by the DAC on the command module. So James Oberg was commissioned by NASA to write a rebuttal on Apollo 14 landing conspiracy theories. However, NASA dropped the project after ABC News Tonight program ran a story about it, claiming it was beneath NASA's dignity to respond to moon landing denialist claims. Oberg has said that he still intends to pursue the project depending on successfully arranging new funding sources. And here's Open Minds TV. I won't read all of that. But basically the gist to this is that Dr. Thornton Page himself said that he was asked, therefore they had to be debunked or something. Dr. Thornton Page said, yes, that was my doing, my contribution. So they were debunkers officially and got paid for it. He said, I guess in the early Apollo flights, there were some joking about UFOs. Oberg debunked this, but lots of people thought that the astronauts had seen UFOs and therefore would be experts on UFOs. That was Dr. Thornton Page quote. Ken Johnson Sr. has told me many times that at the end of the Apollo missions, any physical evidence regarding the Apollo program was thrown out to include images, records, and items considered classified material. It must have been strange, to say the least.
Yeah, this is this whole story that some of it turned up in some McDonald's somewhere.
Yes.
What's that?
Absolutely. Well, what you're talking about at the McDonald's in California, all of that film, all those canisters were actually lunar orbiter films, and they were lunar orbiter 1 through 5, and they were sitting in a garage at one time, and a woman named Nancy took on, she somehow got ownership of all of the film and everything and got those guys together to sort through them and maybe correct them. She thought they were important for history, so she saved them. That's what the guys at the, what's it called, moonviews.com, that's what they're doing. So well, here's Edgar Mitchell. He said there's, yes, her name was Nancy Evans. So
there you
can look that up.
Nancy Evans, well done.
Thank you. There is Edgar Mitchell said, quote, there's life in the universe and we have been visited and UFOs have been covered up by the government for a long time. He of course sadly, passed away recently. September 17, 1930, he was born and February 4th, 2016, he passed away. He was a United States Naval officer, an aviator, test pilot, aeronautical engineer, ufologist, and NASA astronaut. As the lunar module pilot of Apollo 14, he spent 9 hours working on the lunar surface in the Frau Moreau Highlands region, making him the sixth person to walk on the moon. Okay, so here's some anomalies I got from Ken's material, some of his 8x10s. They clearly show things that are flying around in the sky. Ken's images were removed from NASA before they had a chance to paint out all of the backgrounds and such. So that's kind of nice. Here's a little anomaly from one of his slides. That's Dave Scott in the foreground there. And in the background, we see this strange object. Well, I can tell you that all around the object was painted completely black. And the object itself, it expresses the actual pixels. It looks like the, you know, Moonraker space station, but it actually exhibits the actual pixels that were, familiar with the Apollo 15 mission. So here's some pixels on the side that I'm showing over here. And, there's the object, and you can see all around it, it's matte black. So it was painted out.
Okay. So can you just explain for those of us who are not familiar? I mean, I'm very familiar with the idea of pixels and contrast and all that stuff. So, but a lot of the audience may not be, and we have a nice large audience. So welcome everybody. Would you able to explain a little bit about what you mean by these pixels and what, I mean, I can see that they have a particular pattern of distortion. Is what you're saying?
Yes, they do. Yes, they have what they call them image artifacts, you know. So they have the actual pixels that make up an object or a picture, and you don't need any more than two or three to make up an object, you know. These pixels have a certain look to them. These in particular look kind of blocky. They look like buildings, you know. They look like space buildings or big weapons, or I don't know how you would say that, but they look very rectilinear, you know, that sort of thing. If you increase, what I did was I increased the brightness just a little bit so that you could see that it was painted matte black, that there are absolutely no pixels around the area of the object. But within the area of the object, it's very blocky and exhibits the same pixels as the Apollo 15 normal pixels you would see in an image when you zoom in, you know. So let's see, I increased the brightness a little bit. The pixels are typical of the original image and how matte black the rest of the background is. That kind of surprised me. Not really, but this image was manipulated digitally to make it look better for the public, which it does. But the question remains, did they miss the spot on purpose for us to find, or did they just miss the spot, you know, when they painted the whole background black? Whatever the case may be, it's interesting, the shape hovering over the background in this Apollo 15 image. And let's see, we've got this, dish array right here, which is kind of a cool anomaly. It's, this was in an Apollo 15 image, AS-1588-11970. And this, in the background of this lunar image on the surface of the moon is what appears to be some kind of lunar base or, an array of dishes. And that's what I kind of think it is. I think it's an array of dishes. Okay. Here's some details of, the lunar base dish array. The image was analyzed for unknown possibilities of mechanical artifacts as found to be part of an image and not an affectation of poor scanning by a professional photographer. It is truly subject. The subject in the image is as opposed to some kind of reflection. It is exactly what it looks like, an unnatural structure of engineering structure opposed to natural geological lunar formations on the surface due to the array, which would be considered beyond coincidence in nature. In the same way, a crop of corn would be considered engineered on Earth. So there's a bigger picture of this dish array. And there's another one with dishes on the moon on the side of a crater that I found. And this is what's interesting about these is they're actually pointed away from Earth, as we can see, you know, the Earth in the background.
Can we determine exactly where they may be pointing?
Yes, I kind of can. Let's see. They would be pointed north. It's sort of the southern part of the moon, not, pretty good distance away from Tsiolkovsky crater, as we can see there. And they're literally pointed, let's see. It would be the southern part. So it would be, they would be pointing north toward the sun. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Okay. All right. Here is a picture of this strange little anomaly that was sitting in a grouping of craters. It looks like strange gas hoses and a rocket balloon in the Apollo 12 1969 Earthrise image. And they were actually doing, you know, in 1957, they were doing raccoon experiments where a balloon would take a rocket up and then they would, you know, ignite the rocket so that they didn't have to have a fuel base all the way through our atmosphere. Here's a concept of testing by the U.S. Navy in 1957. Van Allen used this to discover radiation in the upper atmosphere. It was impractical as it seemed on Earth. It makes perfect sense on the moon due to its lower gravity and higher payloads. One thing that scientists, this is going to kind of drive them nuts, is that we perhaps have an atmosphere on the moon. They know that there's a very obscure thin atmosphere, or officially they know that. But I think that there's more, because what I'm seeing is a raccoon experiment right here.
Well, if you had no atmosphere at all, that balloon would just explode, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it wouldn't.
And that's looking like a hot air balloon. It's just looking kind of gently. It would be really pushing hard against the outside of the shell.
Yes. And like you said, it was also, known, you know, that the lunar lander didn't really take off from, you know, with rockets or something like that. It would have had to have been lifted up, because it's actually against universal law with the extraterrestrials and that to ignite anything in space. So that's something to consider. Here's the lunar spire. This one is around Sinus Medi, and it's just this weird, looks natural, really, you know. I don't know if it's natural or not, but it's hundreds of miles high. It's miles high. Let's put it that way. Okay. Here's a lunar Acropolis that I found. This is kind of what that looks like. It looks like, you know, like a Greek Acropolis of some sort. This was taken.
That looks like a little village.
Yeah, isn't that cool? It does. It looks like a little village or something. For your audience, that was taken in frame on Lunar Orbiter 3, image 3073_MED. And it's the location is Rima Hyginus in the northeast of Sinus Medi on the horizon. There it is. It's just sitting there.
I would say that looks like a little village in Cyprus.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? It looks exactly like that. I call it an Acropolis. I don't know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Has the Greek feel to it.
This one is what I call lunar ruins. It is from one of Ken's images that he called out. He called it the painted out background image. And the reason why he called it that is because in the official image, it's completely black in the background. And as you can see in his image, it's not. It's pretty, you know, the pixels are very even. And what we're looking at right here, what I'm trying to point out is that white line that goes around and makes a half of a pentagon. So it's almost like a perfect half of a pentagon. I don't know what you call that. I forget. But you can see very clearly there's that white line. And in the official version, that white line is gone. If anyone wants to look up the bench crater anomaly or bench crater Apollo 12, they'll find it on Wikipedia, I believe.
What that looked like to me. Do you want to bring that back? Oh no, you got that there. Yeah, No, leave it. That's a better detail. And that's actually, yeah, so it looked like to me like a tunnel tube. You know, like a train tube.
Yeah, it does. It very much does, but
so anyway,
the size wouldn't probably fit that description because they were on the surface and it was on the horizon, so it wasn't it was people sized. That makes sense. You know, so that basically we're looking at it at a distance, but it's not that far away from where the astronauts were. So it's not ginormous, you know. So we have walls here
for the moment. It's a kind of hour into the show, and
good.
I think it'd be good to take a break. And I have a tune because of YouTube and its crazy copyright, and they'll throw the book at me.
Absolutely.
So I have created some of my own music. So this track is called Mars Conjunct Venus Conjunct Moon. So enjoy this for the next 2.5 minutes. And that sudden ending brings us back suddenly to the moon. Standing on the moon, looking at this very strange thing. Are we on the far side, by the way, or are we on the near side? Oh, Brett isn't back yet. Well, anyway, this is Wolf Spirit Radio and Wolf Spirit TV, available at wolfspiritradio.tv and also at wolfspirit.tv. We're doing a show with Brett Colin Shepherd, and we're looking at some pictures of the moon that you've never seen before. Definitely, and these are just kind of coming out as Brett and Karen are discovering these anomalies on the moon. Yeah, I hear crunching and
hello.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, so sorry, the track ended. It was only a 2.5 minute track, we're back to the moon, and with your with this what can I say? You know, civilization-y looking piece of photograph. I mean, There's not supposed to be anything there, but there obviously right. is. What are we looking at? What are we looking at? And how big is it? You know, say that rock on the side there. There's a rock casting a shadow just underneath the word wall. How tall is that rock, say? Yeah, let's get a sense of proportion.
That ruined wall is about, about 5 or 6 feet high.
Feet. All right. Well, I imagine you were going to say meters. All right. Feet. So that's quite small. All right.
Yeah. Absolutely. Edgar Mitchell was one that said that there were lunar ruins as far as the eye could see. I think we're looking at them. Now, this particular image, you know, is fascinating because, in the official image, they have blurred out the lines that make that wall right there. They were more concerned about that than the objects in the background, which I find fascinating as well because there's perfect masonry cut out. You know, that's not normal for just a natural rock.
No, that certainly doesn't look like anything that was just lying there, for instance.
Right, yeah. So this one really touched me because I thought of the ancients that could have built it and what happened on the moon to cause that kind of devastation. You know, because we know that right now that there's modern lunar bases, but there's also ancient ruins, which I find incredibly fascinating. Were we there? Were our ancestors there? Who knows, you know? I have a feeling they were, you know, based on what I've seen. Would you like me to stay on that one?
Please, continue. No, continue. So there's the, move on to the next one because, that's the one that has the reconstruction of what, see, this is what you're trying to establish here is that this is so secret that the top secret
right.
guys have been all wiped out. You know, like nobody knows about this apart from everybody who's been watching this.
Absolutely.
That these, all right, so what we're seeing here is we're seeing a view of a crater, and in the shadow, just of when you're looking at the shadow of the crater, poking up out of
yes.
the shadow are five shiny, domey-looking things.
Yes.
And then what have we got? Are they satellite dishes up on the top left there, or are they domes?
Yeah, I believe they're satellite dishes because they're pointed at the sun, and they're getting that great reflection right off the sun. You know.
All right, so they could be solar. These could be solar panels.
Yes, absolutely. They could be energy type dishes. You know, creating electricity and so on. There's also the other ones that I found they look like dishes. They look like they have little things underneath them to hold them up and everything, and they're also pointed directly at the sun. So this tells me that our technology that we got on Earth, you know, where we now have solar dishes aimed at the sun and so forth, that we've gotten this technology from them. That's what it tells me. A lot of new things have popped up since the 40s and 50s.
The
so,
other thing.
You know, there's,
sorry. Yeah, there's another thing that has popped up since then. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I've been playing with recently myself. And this is the PIR, the infrared detector that you see everywhere.
Right.
I can't remember. I think it was some channeling or something like that. Some grays were being channeled. And they say, you know, this is our technology. These early warning systems
it
that
is.
We've been using. This is our stuff. You've copied.
Absolutely. You know that there was actually a laser found at the Roswell crash, and the technology that made that work is where we got a lot of that. There was also fiber optic material, and we used it for a different reason on Earth than they used it. when they were guiding their ship.
Really? What were they using the fiber optics for?
It's very fascinating. They were using it to interact with their ship physically through their brain.
How did the fiber optics, they have a fiber optic thing that went straight into their noodles.
Right. And it also has to do with their understanding of light information, the information that photons carry. So this is happening without any three-dimensional material. This is happening all the time. It's why I'm able to see some of these objects on the moon. The moon acts as a great big mirror, the sun basically, shines the light information onto the moon, and it acts as a big reflector back to Earth. So we're actually picking up that light information as well. When we say we have a download, something to that nature, sometimes it's because of that exact thing, that light information.
So this is very interesting. This ties in with a lot of what David Icke's material is about, is that there's something about the moon, using the moon to reflect energy, not from the sun, but from the old sun, Saturn.
Ah, interesting. Yes, the interdimensional sun, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I believe that's quite possible from what I'm seeing, and I'm not the type of person that wants to believe that, but it's what I see. So I will report that, There's that light information, and I couldn't figure out where it was coming from. Why am I seeing two-dimensionally themed images of old ancestors and clowns and different types of themes for each image? And it occurred to me that our ancestors probably got the idea of the gods, their gods, Apollo and all of this, even down to the detail, the stories of the gods from the moon. It really, it struck me as that is one of the truths that I'm dealing with. And it's why I call that extraterrestrial communication. When I'm looking at a graphic image and it's talking to me that way. You know what I mean?
So it's a kind of divination process.
Absolutely. I would consider it a divination.
Yeah. Yes. So, from that.
There's another word for that. It's called, hierophany. It's from the Greek terms, seeing a divine image, like on a rock or something like that. So it's kind of neat. It goes well beyond, any new terms for it. I think pareidolia is one of the new terms, which does not actually describe what I'm seeing because of the themes.
So, where are we? There's more, you got some more, images from the moon here.
Oh, I have a lots of stuff here. Absolutely.
Paperclip. So, paperclip.
Yeah,
one of my favorite little subjects.
Material.
Yeah. Because, yeah, we were talking about, the front project, the NASA, and people say, NASA, oh, never a straight answer. Well, I say Nazis are still active. And like you were saying, it's the front organization for the secret space program, which
Absolutely.
Is really Star Trek was a documentary of the secret space program, except they were Nazis. Is that right?
That's pretty much it. Most of those scientists that came here with Project Paperclip, don't all subscribe to the real stuff, the real esoteric Nazi things. But that's exactly where their technology came from divination.
Well, we had Maria Orsic receiving these Sumerian characters that, you know, they then reinterpreted.
Yes, and those were actually not Sumerian. Sumerian looks like chicken scratch. Those were actually Illyrian symbols.
Illyrian?
Yes.
So
that puts it right into the Pelasgian Empire.
Ah, right. So the Pelasgians, are they anything to do with the Palladians then?
Yes, the Pelasgians, that sort of thing, yes.
Actually, what's their racial characteristic? What do they look like?
They are Nordics, straight up. They're just Nordics. They are the people that came from space to influence humanity and that sort of thing. They're one of the races that came here a long time ago. So there's what was channeled was actually their ancient interaction with some fundamental people that were already here during the age of the Vinca Empire. Now the Vincas were what was like the pre-European cultures. And later those all became the Pelasgian Empire. And this was shortly after this really weird interruption in humanity. When these Nordics came, suddenly they're worshiping Apollo and all of these complex systems of gods and goddesses. So I find that very fascinating technologically, as a spiritual technology. You know, it's a very strange thing. So it really got me thinking about this projection off the moon thing, and how this was designed to give our ancient ancestors this spiritual type technology. From David Icke thinks it's Saturn or evil or whatever. I don't particularly think it's evil. I think it's just from another dimension. You know, to where I disagree with that. You know, I don't think that that's the evil plot or whatever, that these ancient ancestors are the bloodlines of today or anything like that. I think, of course they are, you know, some of them are the bad parts of our tribes and so forth. The people that have perverted things, they actually took this ancestral information from the moon and they perverted it into a duality. They combined it all. You know, one of the specific times where they did this, not to go too far off the topic, but they were sick of sacrificing their own, sacrificing animals for, so that their crops would grow, so that things would happen. So they had decided to combine all of that into one sacrifice, which was completely, in my mind, a fictitious sacrifice. And that's what we have today. We have Christianity, which believes in the one sacrifice for all of our wrongdoings and so on and so forth. So there was a very pinnacle times since then, since 6,000 years ago, you know, where we're at today, as humanity is growing spiritually or I would say devolving spiritually if we can continue on that track. But we really need to get back to our roots, you know? And, I'm always approached by people that are very judgmental, and they say, well, you know, you need Jesus or you need this or that or whatever. I don't think those are bad people. I just think that the programming has taken hold quite well, you know, especially in the United States. So we have this Project Paperclip, and we have these Nazis who were from, I shouldn't even say Nazi, but that's what we call them. But they were actually working for the Roman, Holy Roman Empire. It was actually the Holy Roman Reich out of the Vatican, out of Rome. So a lot of people today, especially the young people, they don't understand that the Holy Roman Empire was actually allies and so forth with the Nazis and Japan, you know. And this Holy Roman Empire had an agenda. It most definitely did. And it was an esoteric one, you know, so they have, some of these rules and how they gain land and so on. And they did a lot of it through their inquisitions. So they would accuse people of witchcraft and all of this, you know, to take their land. And that does have something to do with all of this supernatural esoteric stuff, you know? So the Nazis, they were obsessed with their origins, their space origins from Aldebaran. They feel that that's where they came from, you know, the Nordic beings. So we have that contingent, and some of them really believe that even today. So we have this Project Paperclip where we brought these Nazis over here, and we've actually covertly hidden some of the bad ones like Mengele, some of the horrible ones, you know, that did horrifying things for Hitler and the Roman Empire. And, you know, a lot of this stuff is very confusing to people, this transition of when the Nazis came over to America. But it says right there, though you can't read it real good, and I apologize for that being so small.
Can you zoom in? There's a zoom.
Yeah, I can
zoom,
try to.
There's a button at the top there. There, that one.
Yeah,
there.
I'll zoom into this.
And
here.
I think if you click, it will, or indeed, if you control, hold down the control key and roll your mouse window, your mouse wheel.
Yeah, here we go. All right. Oops. Let's see, where are we at here?
Aha, stuff is going on.
Oh, good.
I think it's very large. Right. There we go. You're so large. It's you're just seeing the black corner of it. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah, let me zoom a little lower.
Click the fit to window there.
Fit. Yeah, fit. Okay. Here we go. Well, that does it small again. Yeah. But,
and then you can zoom into it. There we go.
Okay. There we go. There's our picture. And I'll try that again. Just with 100% maybe. Yeah, that does it a little more, but not too much.
Where is
200. I apologize.
Oh, there it is. Down on the bottom right there, you can see a little slider. That's where your slider is. Can you see
that? Yes.
Bottom right.
Yes.
It says 200%. And then you can scroll it around there. There we go.
Okay, I'll adjust that.
There we go. Right. Yeah, now we're good. I can read that. The Secretary of War has approved the project, whereby certain understanding German scientists and technicians are being brought to this country to ensure that we take full advantage of those significant developments which are deemed vital to our national security. Yes. I had an insight about national security, Brett.
Yes.
As in securities and exchanges, as in bonds, is that national securities are actually a bond, and that's what they're protecting.
Right. Yeah, those bonds are actually us. That's our birth certificates.
That's it.
You know?
So you are a national security in that you have a tax-paying potential.
Yeah. They're welcome. I gave them a fake $1 million. Yes.
Oh, good. Good.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, meanwhile.
You know, I will get that back and we'll go to the next one. Okay, so some conclusions based on information we have. The lunar images have been manipulated, no doubt, in my mind. Okay, there is specific evidence of the existence of lunar bases. There is absolutely no doubt about that. I cannot the only thing I haven't done is produce the actual film that Edgar Mitchell took. Okay, so due to the time frame of the Apollo missions and the film of the lunar surface, there is specific evidence to suggest that these bases are either of extraterrestrial origin or part of a joint secret space program conducted by the U.S. military before the Cold War and after Project Paperclip, World War II, during the Eisenhower administration. And this is, you know, this is when the Russia and the United States was pretty good friends, actually. We didn't have that big of a problem with them. Okay, some conclusions based on this information. There is a vast amount of evidence suggesting that the civilian agency formed by our U.S. military during the Eisenhower administration was a public perception front based on the public's knowledge of our technology at the time, which was fuel-based to hide a secret space program based on recovered Nazi technology from the so-called Nordic aliens, as well as the Roswell UFO crash. So here we have, you know, some of the plans that you saw on the internet with the Hanabu 2s and real craft. Well, this Hanabu looks exactly like what George Adamski saw in the United States. And it looks exactly like what Neil Slade saw in Utah and exactly like what Howard Menger said that he saw on the moon. So,
and how so connected have, that, yeah. Sorry, Brett. How connected is that with, our dear
exactly
friend,
the
Billy,
same.
Billy the Farmer Meyer.
Billy Meyer. Yeah. Billy Meyer. Oh gosh, I don't like that guy. I really don't. But you know, as far as just the story goes, he's talking about this story, but in a different way. You know?
Yeah, so say, we're talking about the same characters here, aren't we?
Absolutely. We're talking about the same influences. So we have these extraterrestrial Nordic influences on our secret space program and on the Nazis who built these craft right here. So we acquired that technology after World War II. And we brought it to the United States, and we actually flew it around. Some of the UFOs that people saw with the balls on the bottom and so forth and three holes in the windows, you know, like portals or whatever, those were Nazi craft. Those were not from aliens. Or, you know, it's alien technology, but it was built by Nazis during World War II. And I believe that we had taken that technology and made it a lot better since then. So we have,
people.
We have some of the, there's people. There's possible extraterrestrials involved with our military and humanity. There's the EBE Roswell type, which I believe are, an etheric being that met with Eisenhower, at Holloman Air Force Base, and they were said to pop in and out of reality. So they were etheric beings at first, and the deal was made so that they could stay here on more of a permanent basis, but they needed biological material to implant their consciousness into. And then there's the Valiant Thor human ET who visited Washington from the planet Venus. And he came with a couple of Venusians. There are the dimensional beings or etheric, which I believe we see a lot when we talk about these, hierophany images, when we see stuff in trees or rocks or something like that. We see it on digital cameras after we take a picture and we notice that there's something strange in them, orbs, all that kind of thing. Then we have the atmospherics seen in the tether video that live living beings in Earth's orbit, which I believe are very real. They're a bit like orbs, but they're a mile across. There's the Nordic type lunar beings, which look like German or Swiss type humans, and I've actually seen these firsthand.
Yeah, that one looks quite Swiss. I've seen Swiss people.
Yes. Yeah, I actually saw one while I was driving along in my van on Highway 10, and I saw these craft coming in toward the road, and one of them stopped right in front of me and moved along at 70 miles per hour following, you know, right in front of me. And I could see this thing. It was huge, you know, and then it rolled over across to a building, and a thing came out of the bottom of it, and, I blinked for a moment in my mind and I saw this image that I'm showing, of this Nordic type being. And I actually saw a little screen pop up that showed my van going down the road. And I feel like I lost a couple of minutes of time, but it seemed longer than that. It was really a strange thing to go through. And, my van, when I popped back into whatever reality I was in, It didn't seem like the blink of an eye, but my van was going, and it seemed like I should have been farther past the UFO that was over, hovering over the building. And, but it wasn't, and my van was going along Highway 10, and I saw the UFO move kind of, like a, off a helipad type movement. And they moved like fish in water, you know, not like, something that was propelled by an engine or something like that. And it was completely silent. It went back up. It was, hexagonal type shape, and it went back, moved very quickly toward the mountains and attached with other craft that were there. And the whole thing moved simultaneously like one big craft. It was really strange to see. But, you know, that's some of the extraterrestrial experiences I've had. Aside from looking at the lunar images and seeing these dimensional type beings within the lunar images. And I think they're tied to our ancestors in that lunar type of way, you know, how they worship the moon and all that jazz.
Well, there's a story, I got it through, I think it's David Wilcock, says that the Chinese say that they arrived in the moon from Epsilon Eridani, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
So that's their story. So, you know, there must be some, you know, and presumably that the Chinese disembarked and maybe left a skeleton crew who have since become greys or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, de-evolved or something.
Yeah. There is something very complex going on with that for sure. It has to do with our ancestors in the moon and, you know, all of this Nazi technology and, you know, our secret space program and all of that. This slide here shows, Tesla's UFOs that he actually had diagrams for, and they look a lot like, the Billy Meyer saucers. A whole lot like them, actually. So it's human technology with ET help is what I think it is. Alien reproduction vehicle. We've seen that one, during the disclosure project. Someone was showing that. There's the UFOs of Nazi Germany, American acquired technology. These Vril craft, and Hanabu craft look a lot like what people that have seen UFOs saw in the 1950s. You know, they're that classic style. And they're all pretty much, the same. They look like that. And other people that have seen things that do not look like that, I believe they're seeing kind of the real thing or, reversed, engineered technology that they developed.
These ones look very much like they're made in panels and riveted together, whereas the real deal, as it were, is completely seamless.
Yes, absolutely. You know, almost alive.
Well, according to my contact from the Pleiades, yeah, they are alive. They're built with their brain, yes. Brain cells from the child.
Wow.
So they grow the ship. The pilot and the ship grow together, and the pieces of brain cell grow into the AI matrix of the ship. So they
wouldn't doubt that. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is how they're able to steer really quick.
Oh yeah, yeah. They move like a consciousness, like they're a fish in water.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So yeah, with the continuous and surmounting reports of UFOs, lunar anomalies that look like structures, strange graphic and telepathic communication, as well as the bizarre relations that the U.S. government has with its citizens over the years, it is no wonder that people have obviously have questions regarding the true nature of their human experiences, a personal experience for which the individual is the only expert. Why would we choose to not listen to that expert, the experiencer who was actually there? And some of these reasons are engineered by skeptics and debunkers who were hired to dismiss these issues from the public perception. In spite of the attacks, the experiencer still feels the need to tell their story, of which the belief, which belief in their story is unnecessary. But just to listen to one another as human beings who have an extraordinary experiences, the worst that could happen is that we might learn something new. From my personal experiences, with very close encounters with UFOs and telepathic, as well as the graphic communications with ETs, I know without a doubt whatsoever that we are never alone. And here's some quotes from astronauts. This one says, at no time when the astronauts were in space were they alone. There was a constant surveillance by UFOs, Scott Carpenter. Photographed a UFO while in orbit May 24th, 1962. NASA still has not released this photograph. I've been asked about UFOs, and I've said publicly that I thought UFOs, UFOs, were somebody else, some other civilization. Eugene Cernan, commander of Apollo 17. I think that Walter Shearer aboard Mercury 8 was the first astronaut to use the code name Santa Claus to indicate the presence of flying saucers next to the space capsules. However, his announcements were barely noticed by the general public. Pilot Walter Shearer. Please be informed that there is a Santa Claus. Astronaut James Lovell, Apollo 8, December 25th on Christmas, 1968.
Good little cover.
Isn't that fun? Not every discovery has been announced. Dr. Farouk El Baz, NASA scientist. I believe that the extraterrestrial vehicles and their crews are visiting this planet from other planets. Most astronauts were reluctant to discuss UFOs. Major Gordon Cooper, astronaut, testifying under oath to the United Nations. I did have occasions in 1951 to have 2 days of observations of many flights of them, of different sizes, flying in fighter formation generally from east to west over Europe. Major Gordon Cooper, astronaut. And this was earlier when he was a pilot. I know other astronauts. I'm sharing my feelings, and we know that the government is still sitting on hard evidence of UFOs. Colonel Gordon Cooper, January 14, 1997. Russia and the U.S. have announced that they are definitely planning several space machines, so it is quite possible that the first spaceships or satellites may occur. Other interplanetary machines, manned or otherwise, our space devices may even be closely approached by such alien machines. That's Major Don Kehoe, U.S. Marine Corps, November 29th, 1957. And disclosure from entities that have lied to us will never be credible or acceptable. The closest thing we have to disclosure is our own human and extraterrestrial experiences. That's my quote, you know.
Brett, talking of entities that are lied, real girl, she's been asking questions all night. But I've got to get some in because, you know, your testimony is, very complete. But I want to get this one in because she's been asking, bless her. Can you please ask about the Draco reptilian race? It's not mentioned anything, is it? It is thought that the Dracos told the astronauts to leave the moon.
The Draco are probably not the ones that said, don't come back, you're too immature, from Apollo 17. But I do remember that quote. It's hearsay. But it was circulated around NASA as fact. You know, so there is a lot going on with that particular quote, you know, that they picked up the ham radio. The operator said that they said, well, Apollo 17, don't come back because you're not ready yet. Those were not Dracos that said that. I don't believe that they were anyway. If they were anybody, they were the Nordics that Eisenhower had the first deal with in 1952 when they took him to the moon. And they're beings that love us very much. They care about us. They don't want us to blow ourselves up or anyone else. They're the ones that actually are affiliated with humanity. They're not the ones that don't look like us or something like that. And these particular Nordic type beings, some are actually etheric. They're spiritual type beings, you know, and they've actually been seen in space as well. And I know this sounds extraordinarily far-fetched, and there is a lot of hearsay regarding some of these things. Some of it is religiously biased, so you know, I want people to use discernment, you know, when they look at some of these things. I've done this investigation proper, I think. I've gone lengths to see that the information is actually accurate, you know. I studied Ken Johnston's story about the lunar base, and there were a lot of things that weren't jiving with me, so I looked them up, you know. I actually did the research and I made sure that he was what he said was true. And so when, you know, and finding these things in the lunar transcripts of Apollo 14, it's undeniable that that his debunkers, you know, have said that there were no films at all from a 16 millimeter camera, but right in the transcripts, there's Edgar Mitchell saying that he's filming Tsiolkovsky Crater. So that's a fact to me, you know, that film actually exists. And like the film, or the image that Scott Carpenter is talking about of the craft out in space, out the window of the command module, they will not, let the public know that's a reality, that there's life out there in space. Where in the world did we come from if there's no life out in space? We're not alone, you know.
I agree. And also, nobody here listening to this program was ever an amoeba on this planet, or a monkey.
No.
Or a salmon. I mean, you can exist as a salmon if you like, but it's not a linear thing, and the humans didn't come from this planet.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is, you know, this is a general consensus really amongst a certain level of researcher, that when you dig back, you find that, you know, there's a non-Earth origin about this whole thing.
Yeah, it is, you know, really my message is I really want to know people to know how special they are, how important they are in the universe. That we're being watched. We are being watched by people that care about us, that are our co-descendants of our ancestors. You know, they're out there. And these other entities, you know, etherics, who religious people call demons, greys or whatever, they have an agenda, but I don't, you know, we're living in this universe together. They're no better or worse than we are. And these Draco reptilians, they're older than us on this planet.
Certainly. And really, you know, the only problem I've got is my position on the food chain.
Well, yeah, that's true. I can tell you firsthand that they used to murder people. They used to sacrifice people. That was what that big change of religion was all about that I was talking about earlier, where they had been murdering too many people, sacrificing too many animals and people. I'm trying not to be completely graphic, you know, but they used to throw their babies in the fire, so to speak. They decided to have a representation of one sacrifice, you know, which was the Jesus character. And this wasn't the first time they've thought this or done this. Every son of a god was that sacrifice throughout history. Even in the original story, Hercules was thrown down to live among the mortals. You know, it was at first a punishment. So, these types of sacrifices.
Let me say, there are quite a few mortals that living amongst would be an eternal torture. So, you know, you can understand why that might be a big deal, you know, in those days.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think there's a huge complexity there as far as the human spirit. You know, the human spirit is extraterrestrial. Where else would it come from? You know, whether it comes from the space in front of our mamas or whether it comes from deep space, we're still of an extraterrestrial source. We're walking around in these bodies that are able to breathe this atmosphere, you know. So it's very interesting.
This atmosphere, that's a very interesting, another way, another tangent indeed, is the whole atmosphere and terraforming. And is there a kind of battle to create the appropriate environment for a winning race? Or, you know, are they trying to do that sort of competition? They're trying to make it so that their race survives better than ours. And who are they, and who are us, and who are we?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that there's going to be an emerging race of reptiles coming out from the earth or something, you know, after they've completed the mediation of our atmosphere to fit their needs. You know, I don't think that's true. I think they envy us a great deal. I think the reptilian and great consciousness, they would love to become human. And since they can't really, they settle for these biological bodies that they've made.
Because
that's
the heart.
To live on Earth, yeah.
That's it. Because it's the heart that makes you human. And these races have managed to, what's the word? Justify, easing the heart out of their reality. And so living a heartless reality, you gain the benefits of living in such a society. But that, you know, but those of us who do have a heart have to live with these people.
Oh yeah. You know, we do. We have to get along, you know, or not, you know. I don't know how to put that. We should get along. We should.
As Dave Corso says, as Dave Corso says, we should learn to play nice.
We should learn to play nice. Yeah, that's exactly right. I think that we're on the right track. I think in many ways we're primitive compared to the spiritual and other technologies that our co-descendants have out in space. You know, I think that I don't believe they're demons, because, you know, that even that thought form didn't come about till the 16th century. You know, that's
really?
Absolutely. The whole idea of a devil and the manifestation of a physical devil on Earth and all of this, this devil character with the horns and all that kind of grew out of some of the older ideas from Panacea, from Pan, the character with the goat horns and hooves and all that jazz, you know. So this character came about pretty gradually and kind of peaked in the 16th century, especially through Dante's Inferno and other books like that. So yeah, that's basically it. It's kind of like the Santa Claus character comes from the old Norse Odin, you know, and earlier the Mani character from the moon, the god of the moon. So yeah, there's a lot of things that human beings have forgotten because it was engineered that way. It was designed for us to forget, our origins. And I would imagine the bad guys there would be the Roman Catholic Church, who had decided to make a one world religion and ignore the gnosis part of it, you know, the knowledge part, and just forget all that. And they rewrote it under a pen name called Josephus. You know, so there's a lot going on there.
There certainly is. So, Brett, it's been a ride through time, space, and multiple dimensions. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much for kicking off this 2017 year into the near lower Earth orbit, or further, far Earth orbit, lunar Earth orbit, and getting it, getting going. I think we got some, you know, this is, would you like to do some more of these presentations with more of your stuff further on down the line?
Yeah, of course. Anytime, JP. I enjoyed it very much. I think it's important for us to all learn together to go forward.
Thank you.
Believe me, I'm not interested. I'm obviously not interested in doing this to show my ginger head, you know, on your program. But just, you know, it's one of the things that I feel passionate about. I just want to share my human experience. Otherwise, I don't know why the hell I'm here, you know?
You know, I want to give due credit also to your partner, Karen, who has provided the perspective for you to see the things that you've been seeing and describing in this show. I just wanted to.
Yeah, absolutely. I also want to point out that Karen's coming out with a new book and she wants to talk to you too.
Yay. Well, we'll have a.
She's coming out with a book called Anunnaki on the Moon.
Well then, that's going to be a perfect. Now, so you've done the setup there. You know, we've done all the setup for the book. So that's perfect.
Yeah.
So Brett Colin Shepherd, thank you very much. This has been, Ever Beyond TV. Oh, I love it. Where's the, outro? There we go. We'll be going back to Wolf Spirit Radio. If you want to close your players and come back to Wolf Spirit Radio, so that you can, hear the next show, which is, Healings and Meditations with Frank Jordan. Thank you very much, everybody.
Really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you very much. God bless you, Brett.
You're welcome.
Beyond.